Hello, welcome to Hat of Many Things again with me, Mike, and my co-host,
Tom.
Joining us today, very excitedly for me, we have our guests, Johanna Pettersson, which I probably just mauled, and Jason Carl from White Wolf. We're going to be discussing what makes a good roleplay character, and then going on to some V5 stuff with the upcoming release, which is very cool. So, Johanna and Jason, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourselves, a little bit about your history, who you are, and maybe some links to any social media handles you might have?
Hi, I'm Jason Carl. I'm the producer of V5 at White Wolf. I'm also the executive VP of community development at White Wolf. You can find me online everywhere, from Twitter to Instagram to Facebook to Spotify, under the acronym, or I should say the moniker, Vampires and Vino, which is vampires, the letter N, and vino. Because two of my hobbies are vampires and wines.
Yeah, my name is Johanna Pettersson, and I'm a Finnish game designer. I worked on V5 doing some of the, maybe 10% of the core book, but then my sort of main task was to write for the Anarch book, which is still sort of forthcoming later in the fall, and I've wrote most of that. And beyond that, I've done a lot of live-action role-playing games and also published a couple of indie role-playing games before this. And I think the best way to find me on social media is by Googling my name, which is probably very difficult for people to sort of grasp from this voice, but I will write it in the chat.
So today we're discussing roleplay gaming with the subcategory of what it means to be a good roleplayer and how to be one. Tom, quick summary, since we've done a whole podcast on the theme, what is roleplay gaming for anyone who may not know?
Well, we normally start with a definition, so I'm just going to go with the first paragraph on Wikipedia here. A role-playing game is a game in which players assume the roles of characters in a fictional setting. Players take responsibility for acting out these roles within a narrative, either through literal acting or through a process of structured decision-making of character development. I think that basically sums it up. It's taking on a role while playing in a game. And today we're going to be discussing what's the best way to play, really, I suppose. Well, maybe not the best way, but what are the different ways of playing, and how are they good in different ways, and how do they help your DM or GM run the game?
Sure. Are we talking about this specifically in the context of Vampire the Masquerade 5th edition, or in
So I was hoping to have a discussion on roleplay games in general, and then second sort of half just cut into V5 in specifics and the product and what's coming out. So in general, because one of the crib notes I've got later on is going to be not just how are you a good player, but how does it change from game to game, setting to setting, and system to system? What's consistent and what varies? Because what makes a good character or player in V5 may differ to what makes a good character or player in Dungeons & Dragons.
Oh, gosh, this is going to be great. I disagree with you already.
Well, there are things that will be the same and there are things that will differ, I think.
I think there's a wide gulf of difference between what makes a good character and what makes a good role player. Those are wildly different.
Yeah, and that's one of the talking points on this sort of crib sheet that we've got, is what is the difference between those things. So to start off with, Jason, what would you say playing involves? At a table, yourself, how would you describe playing a game to someone who's not played it? What actions are you taking?
Sorry, can you rephrase that? Those are three different questions in one question. Can you ask me one question and I'll be happy to answer it?
Yeah, okay. So what does playing involve?
Doing things. You have to do stuff. If you're a player at the table, your primary responsibility, beyond the consent and safety and boundaries that you've agreed to before the game with your fellow players and your game master, is doing things. You should be asking yourself at all times, what am I doing? How can I do things that make the game fun and interesting for me, for my game master, and for all the other players? Follow up leads, investigate mysteries, ask questions, poke into things, stick your nose where it doesn't belong. Make sure your character is always doing something, talking, regardless of what it is. And if you're not playing a character that would do anything, probably not being a very good player.
Yeah, you'd be an NPC, really, wouldn't you?
Yeah, so that's my number one piece of advice is do things. Always be doing things and always be figuring out what you can do.
Do you have anything to add to that, Johanna?
Yeah, I think that's a very good starting point. I have a kind of like a cheat thing for character creation, which I call the enable-disable dichotomy from developed originally by Markus Montola, another Finnish designer. The idea is that you can break down role-playing character characteristics into enabling and disabling ones. A disabling one would be shy, for example, or cowardly characteristics that make it difficult to do anything, while enabling ones would be brave or foolhardy or prone to poking your nose into other people's business. And if you have a character who is full of those enabling qualities, then you can follow Jason's advice very easily, because then you are always doing stuff instead of not doing stuff. And for me, the tool has been very useful in kind of making sure that characters that I design, especially for myself, are enabled, that they can easily start doing stuff while staying true to the character.
So do you think people should avoid disabling characteristics, or do you think they should minimize and have a healthy ratio where there are more enabling characteristics than disabling characteristics?
For me, I think that what I did after I sort of learned of this analytical tool of breaking down into these two categories, I immediately made myself a character who was basically a list of all the enabling characteristics. And then I started playing that character, and that was a great success. It's a total action character. You could, like, always charging ahead. But after that, every single time I've made another character for myself for a new game or for a new campaign, I always tried to also include some disabling characteristics just to keep it interesting or to give myself a challenge.
So I think that's a really interesting way to approach it. And I think that perhaps when you're making characters with a group as opposed to on your own and then all coming to a table, it could be a really good idea to discuss the disabling or enabling characteristics in that way. And if one person takes a disabling characteristic, another player could take an enabling characteristic that enables the character that wouldn't ordinarily do something. The I'll drag you along or I'll get you involved, so that everybody has reasons to interact with each other in ways that counteract player flaws in a fun way.
That's a very good idea. It's more easy for me to play a shy character if somebody else is playing a very forward and brave character, so I can just sort of tag behind them and still get somewhere.
And then that person kind of needs to push the shy character in order for the synergy to really manifest, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
I think that's important to point out too, that even the shy character that Johanna describes does not necessarily mean that it's passive. It's still an active character, right? It's not necessarily that the character finds itself moved to the back of the action and doing nothing. The character may be shy or socially reticent or observant, but they're making active choices. That's important.
You mentioned in your, as you started talking about what playing involves, Jason, that it's with the consent of everyone at the table and things like that. What are your thoughts on player etiquette and table manners?
That's a fine question and a and a rather deep one. There's been a lot of wonderful scholarly work done recently, both in the tabletop role-playing and live-action role-playing spaces, about social contracts, both explicit and understood, and about determining consent and boundaries between players and between players and storytellers. And I think that one of the most useful things that any playing group can do is to have what's been called a session zero, a time to get together and talk before the game begins, before the very first play session, about shared expectations about what each player wants from the game or hopes to achieve or hopes to feel from the game, and about what the boundaries are that they would like to set. Some games, particularly games that are horror themed, like Vampire the Masquerade, can support some very mature, dark, and intense themes. And not everybody is comfortable with every theme and situation. So I think it's critical for everybody to talk about what they hope to get out of it and what they hope to experience and what their definition of fun is, because it's not the same for each person. One player is sense of fun may come from defeating explicit challenges and obstacles through through fighting or combat. And that's where they derive their enjoyment. A different player might want nothing to do with combat and want to engage in a kind of procedural mystery in the game world. Yet another may want to feel intense emotions that they don't want to, that they don't normally have a chance to feel in their everyday life. They all define success and enjoyment differently. And unless they talk about that together, honestly and openly, they're going to have come away from the game maybe feeling dissatisfied and not getting exactly what they wanted out of it. And that was probably a longer answer than you wanted.
No, that's a very good answer.
I've always said that a large part of role-play gaming and whether you're going to enjoy it or how much you're going to enjoy it depends on the GM and the group. And a great group can make up for a decent GM that's not incredible and can make a game incredible, or a great GM can make up for an otherwise lackluster group. But if you really get the balance right, where everybody is after the same thing and that's what's being provided, then it's just one of the best hobbies you can hope to engage in.
I would recommend that you ask Johanna about an absolutely incredible live action experience, or several live action experiences that he's run connected to a tabletop game universe. He's logged a lot of hours in this area.
Johanna, tell us about Parliament by Night.
Oh, Parliament of Shadows.
Yes.
Well, now that you ask.
this is awesome.
For us, it's the third vampire LARP that I've done in recent years. The first one was End of the Line. The second was Enlightenment in Blood. The third one was Parliament of Shadows with Bjarke Pedersen and Maria Pettersen also in the... as team lead. And with each of those three LARPs, we were always kind of thinking about, like, what kind of parts of the World of Darkness would we want to, like, do for real? Make it to a LARP, like, and have this physical experience of doing this. And with Parliament of Shadows, this question of, like, taking it as close to reality as possible was, I think, taken to an extreme. Because in Vampire, there's always this idea that the vampires are politically connected and they're powerful. But historically, when you read through old vampire books, they are not like this side, they don't go into minute detail about this. And we had the opportunity, because we had some connections in the European Parliament. I was living in Brussels at the time. And Maria Pettersen, who was also my wife, who worked on the LARP, worked there. And that created for us the opportunity to do a vampire LARP where the vampires are, like, literally in the European Parliament, like the real European Parliament, or in this case, because of practical issues, they were actually ghoul characters. But anyway, the servants of the vampires are literally there lobbying. And we had two real actual MEPs playing themselves.
They weren't British ones, were they? Because the British MEPs are basically leeches, so...
No, there was one from Finland and one from Germany, but that was the deal. We kind of promised that in this LARP, when you play a ghoul who is a political vampire lobbyist, you will go to the parliament and you will be treated as if you were a real lobbyist, and you will go to have a meeting with a real MEP, and then you can use your vampire powers on the MEP. and all of that can be played out in like 100% authentic real settings. And then, because we had to kind of take into account security issues and all of that, all of those kind of things, we also had something like 10 other locations, just to give it some like city game style verisimilitude. We had the Brussels Arc de Triomphe, which is a magnificent thing, and a lot of stuff like that, because it turns out that you can get a lot of crazy venues if you just sort of ask them.
it's amazing what people will give you access to if you simply ask politely.
Well, that's been my approach to getting guests on this show, and it's managed to rope two of you in. So I suppose if you don't ask, you don't get.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
That's always the rule.
So how long did Parliament of Shadows run for?
We had a workshop day that lasted for 6 hours, and then on a Thursday, and then Friday, full day of play, and then on Saturday, another something like 5 to 6 hours.
So it's like a weekend event.
A weekend event, yeah.
That sounds incredible. I would.
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
that was the thing, but I have to admit that the key reason for doing it was just to just to break that barrier.
Just to say that you've done it, really.
Yeah, because I thought that from this point onward, LARP has now been in this building. Like, this is now a LARP space.
You've set precedent.
Yeah, exactly. Precedent has been set. So I think the only place after this that now needs to be LARPed is the US Congress.
Oh, man.
Okay, so cool.
Okay. Why do you always ask the impossible of me?
Well, the challenge has been set, Jason.
Yeah, we brought one of the amazing LARPs that Johanna has worked on is also based on Vampire the Masquerade tabletops, and that's End of the Line. And it's an incredibly intense experience that we brought to the Grand Masquerade, the World of Darkness fan convention in New Orleans in 2016.
Which, yeah, I really wanted to go set up, but I did not have the budget.
Well, yeah, hold that thought. Could happen again really soon. But there was a great workshop for the players before that, for that experience. And it's really the LARP equivalent of the session zero that we were talking about, to bring it full circle. It's that initial, honest, open communication about what are we all here to do? How do we all define fun? And where are the places we want to go and don't want to go together? Whether it's a LARP or a tabletop or an immersive theater experience, it's time well spent. And everybody's going to get more from the experience if they engage in it.
So in that regard, Johanna, with a LARP, you've got a larger playgroup usually. So is that much, much harder to organize, to arrange, to find out what everyone's comfortable with in a LARP? Or do you have to set more general guidelines because you can't possibly cater to everybody, so you need to set a baseline?
I think that in a LARP, because it is more difficult. It is more difficult because there's so many more people. So I think that might be the reason why there's been so much more discussion about not only safety, but just like how do we build trust and how do we make people comfortable and what boundaries are and so forth in the context of LARP. And also why LARP has, or different LARP traditions have, I think at this point, quite good toolboxes for how to make those things happen. Jason mentioned the workshop we did for End of the Line in New Orleans, and we put a lot of effort into that because we thought that, okay, we're going to have players here, because End of the Line was originally run in Helsinki in Finland with a very different player base. So we thought, okay, how can we make sure that this LARP works with American players who we don't necessarily know? So we want this to be like accessible to this new player group. And when we were doing that, we could sort of fall back on this this tradition of thinking about these issues. But I think a tabletop game, when we consider tabletop, in a sense, it presents a wonderful opportunity. Or at least I think so, because it has like four players or five players who are like these specific people. Like this person right here is one of the players. These specific individuals. And that means that it doesn't have to be tailored like a LARP. We'll try to find some kind of common ground for like 100 people. But instead, we can do it for like these five people. And with these five people who are sitting around like my table, we can talk very individually about what kind of things work, what kind of things don't work. Since I think that we are responsible to those people most of all when we are playing a tabletop game. And I think that creates a wonderful opportunity to build trust and to create a very cohesive gaming group.
So we've been very sort of open with the discussions about, but do you think there is a right or wrong way to play a game?
I think that like as long as everybody has the experience they want, then there cannot be then the game is good. Then it's played the right way. I think there are some ways that if, for example, players have very, very different expectations, then it can kind of go off the rails. But I don't think those have anything to do with the specific style of play. Like if everybody is playing the same game, if everybody is having a good experience, I think this is something that you really... I think this is, at least for me, what I learned from experience, that if I look at the tabletop role-playing game or a LARP, and I can clearly see that every single person in here is having a great time. And I might have the feeling that, okay, maybe some aspect of it is not well-designed. For example, it's a very common thought when you're a game designer, you're critical about things like that. But at the same time, these people are clearly having a great experience. I can see that with my eyes. So it's very hard for me to say that, no, this game is not great, when it clearly is happening. So that, I think, teaches some humility when it comes to right and wrong ways to play.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that role-playing game designers learn early, I certainly did. I've been writing RPGs most of my adult life, not only Vampire the Masquerade and various iterations, but Dungeons & Dragons 3rd Edition and Hollow Earth Expedition and others, is that once the game is written, it doesn't belong to you anymore. It belongs to the players. It belongs to the fans. It belongs to the people who are going to play it. And they love it as much as you do. And their love is as pure as your love. And there is no wrong way to love a thing like role-playing games. Players will put their own spin on it, their own twists, their own interpretations, and they'll think of things that are far more clever and interesting than we could have ever thought of. And as long as they're having fun and they're being respectful and enjoying it, I say that there's absolutely no wrong way to enjoy a thing. There is no such thing as bad wrong fun.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It's a constant pushback when people ask the cast of Critical Role why they do things a certain way, and they sort of criticize it, and the constant response they give us is that they give the fans who criticize them is, well, stop telling us how to have fun. And I think that's quite right. There is no right or wrong way to have fun, as long as everyone at the table is having fun.
I think that's the appropriate response. You mentioned Critical Role, and streaming has been a really illuminating advancement, a huge advancement in role-playing games. It completely demystifies the whole hobby. It shows everyone exactly what it is, and it shows that there are an infinite number of ways to have fun with the same game. I mean, how many thousands of Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition streams are there, actual play streams are there? Many, many thousands, right?
There are a handful of really big ones, but everybody's trying to stream it now because everybody's having fun doing it.
Yeah, that's the point, right? Everybody's having fun, but they're all having fun in their own particular individualistic way. And that's been, I think, wonderful for the hobby. White Wolf just announced the last few days a partnership with Geek & Sundry to do a Vampire the Masquerade 5th edition stream. We'll do an official streaming campaign starting in September.
I've got some players from... I ran a Vampire the Masquerade 20th edition game for a year and a half. That ended about 3 months ago. And that was their first experience with World of Darkness. So they've come from Dungeons & Dragons, Stars Without Number, and Shadowrun to World of Darkness, which was a much more mature, dark game than they were used to.
And much more political.
Yes. Tom was one of my players. He was very much used to being given a quest. And I would sit there and I'd say, well, what are you going to do tonight? And he'd be like, so... You know, we had to try and get him into that more proactive mindset where his character is motivated to achieve personal goals, not just a quest they've been given. And yeah, there's huge differences there. But I've got some players who will probably be very interested to watch that stream to see how other people play World of Darkness, how other people portray clans and characters.
I think they won't be alone, but they're going to see that we're going to make decisions as a troop. We're going to make decisions as a coterie, both in and out of game, that are for fun and enjoyment and entertainment and not necessarily what the player at home might do. And it'll be very interesting to see the gap between what we do and what people think they would have done and the dialogue that happens between them.
Yeah, I mean, I find that World of Darkness, compared to a lot of games as well, is very... It's less predictable, it's less quest-based, it's less, here is just the story for you to follow, and it's far more about people and their relationships with other people and how those are affected and how they react to that.
I think that's absolutely true. The Vampire the Masquerade in particular is a game about relationships between characters. And it's a very moral game about highly immoral monsters and the relationships that they have.
Saying that, how many games descend into Humanity Fall Murder Hobos?
No, I couldn't begin to guess. In my experience, not as many as you might think.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to play Vampire, is to look at the themes of it and play with the themes of it. It's very easy to get involved in the power trip of, my character can do this, my character can do that. There's potentially no consequences. But my favourite way to play or to run or to watch Vampire is when people are really getting involved in the moral beliefs of their characters and which lines they don't want to cross. And then finding really good reasons for them to cross them.
Finding great reasons to cross them. We when we talk about V5 specifically in a bit, we'll talk about how the new V5 rules do exactly that.
As I say, we've touched on it a little bit, and we mentioned it at the start. What is the difference between a good character and a good player, or is there one?
I'm going to let Johanna take the first crack at that, because I know he has opinions about this, because we've talked about it at length.
I can do that. I think there's a lot of... I think the question of who's a good player is kind of complicated, because I have when I run a game just for fun, I always try to have at least one person in the group who has never played in one of my games before, just to keep things fresh and interesting. And also, I've had many first-timers. And from that, I've learned that many first-timers, especially if they are the only first-timer in an experienced group, pick it up really fast. So you can have somebody who has never played before, so obviously they don't have the skill since they're first-timers. But still, they are surprisingly good at playing the game. But on the other hand, there are still skills you learn from experience of how to be a good player, like how to take other people into account, how to build up other characters, sort of through your playing, how to be a considerate player, how to come up with cool ideas that push the game forward, how to take initiative and so on. All those kind of things are, I think, skills that you will learn. But for me, the character is almost like a tool. It's a tool that the player uses to access the fiction of the game. It's kind of my portal into the game. So the question is it a good tool or a bad tool? What kind of a tool is it? Does it give me what I want as a player so that so things work? I made an experiment some years ago with a vampire game. It was a Sabbat game, and in the Sabbat, the vampires are sort of embraced to become a vampire from humans in a very slapdash fashion, that the Sabbat vampires just kidnap a bunch of random people, hit them over the head, and do a horrible ritual, and then those who survive the ritual are in the Sabbat. And I had this genius idea that we wouldn't have to define the characters beforehand, but they would sort of emerge improvised during the playing out this process, because everybody goes through this process. And as a result, everybody... not everybody, half the group got very obvious, unplayable, badly designed characters, because they had come up with just random improvisations instead of thinking it through. And in that game, we had five players, two of whom dropped out after the first few sessions because they didn't like the characters. But I think the lesson from that is that you get a good character if you put a little bit of work into it, instead of trying a method like the one I experimented with, of kind of trying to just improvise it.
So we did something similar to that, where we made a human, and then we were shovel-headed, and our clan was randomized.
But in that example, you still made the human.
Yes, we did. But we had to go through all the change. So that was an interesting way of doing it. It was not as random as the way you did it.
I think that method already makes more sense. In retrospect, my idea was a bad idea, but it was something we tried.
And there's no harm in trying a new way of generating a character. I mean, one of the points we've also got here is what is good character creation? And not Vampire, I'm afraid, but a game I've run a few times is Fate. And one of the things I love about that is the round table part, where you pass it around and you have to come up with a reason to draw other characters into your backstory, which ensures the group of players is already kind of invested in each other. You don't have to have that session where they all meet in a tavern, you know, the stereotypical D&D, oh, you all met in a tavern and now you're on a quest for some reason. You have that built in from the backstory.
Yeah, I have a couple of kind of rules which I institute in pretty much every game I run regarding characters. And those are like every character in this group wants to be in this group with these other characters. Very simple, but the game will suffer if that's not true for everybody. Another rule is that all characters must want to do the things that the character do in this game. So, for example, if it's a combat-heavy game, all characters must want to fight, because it's sometimes you can almost act by accident make a mistake with this, or at least I don't know about you, but I've made those mistakes.
Oh, I've made the mistakes too. We've all made those mistakes.
You can throw curveballs with it, though, because we played a Dark Heresy game where the GM said, we're going to be playing a Special Forces deniable operations game. So bear that in mind when you make characters. And I handed him a sheet and he sort of said, are you serious? I was like, yeah, why? He's like, it's a Special Forces game. Your character can't run, you can't jump, you can't shoot, you can't climb, you can't fight. I said, yeah, but you can acquire all of the equipment we need. It still works, as long as it works with the group, even if it doesn't directly do what you're expecting.
But yeah, definitely. But that's still in some kind of a relationship to the thing that's being done.
Yeah, if you make a character completely divorced from the setting, like, oh, we're going to play in a desert and I would like to play a fish, you're going to struggle.
Yeah, that would be a problem.
I mean, that's a problem. There is some responsibility, of course, to create a character that is appropriate to the setting and the genre, which is why you talk about things before you start to play. You don't make your character in a vacuum away from everybody else and then just show up expecting to play just because the character type is in the book.
Expecting to play a ninja in medieval Europe.
Yeah, right, exactly. How do you work that in? If you really want to play a ninja in medieval Europe and that's not the genre of the game, you might want to find a different game. It's almost easier to say what makes a good player by saying what not to do than what to do. Maybe that's not fair. Maybe it's equally easy to say.
Yeah, the list of 1,000 things Mr. Welch can no longer do in an RP, almost every one of those would enhance the game.
It can get quite extensive. Right?
Yeah, as long as it's not done more than once, it can enhance the game.
Do this, but once and once only, thank you.
So, you know, being a good player and making a good character are separate, because you can make the best character in the world that's got this detailed backstory, but if your backstory is never drawn into the game, it's not relevant, it's not anything the GM can use, it's just something that you like to tell everyone about, then it's not enhancing the game itself, just enhancing your character. Or if you make this amazing character that's really interesting and detailed, but you're just an asshole at the table that, you know, is eating all the snacks, not bringing anything, generally being rude to everyone, and even worse, making someone feel uncomfortable, then it doesn't matter how good your character is, you're still a bad player.
Sure. Those are several different things packed into one very broad statement. I'm going to try to unpack them a little bit. You know, your character doesn't really exist outside of the things that your character does at the table, right? You can write the most glorious backstory that you want. You can write it with, you know, you can write it with the same style and panache as Joe Abercrombie or Patrick Rothfuss or George R. R. Martin or Mercedes Lackey. But
Patrick is God. I love Patrick.
I don't know if I would go that far, but you know, he's a pretty good guy.
he has a godly beard. I'll give him that.
I'm going to tell him you said that. you can write all this glorious backstory with finesse and beautiful prose. But if it doesn't materialize through your character's actions at the table, it doesn't matter. You can write 20 pages about what an amazing political manipulator your character is, or what a fantastic rock and roll singer they are. But if they never sing rock and roll music in the game, or if they don't engage in shrewd political machinations, it doesn't matter. The character only exists through the actions at the table that the other players can see and react to. And I don't think it's anybody's responsibility to read your 20-page backstory, as much fun as it might be. We can't read each other's minds. We can't see into each other's hearts. So we have to show what we want the game to be through action and speech at the table, rather than the preliminary backstory work that we've done.
But I agree with what Jason said about sort of where the sort of reality of the game is, because the game is about the things that happen in the social interaction in when we play a tabletop game, like around the table when we talk. The talking is the game, and all of the other actions related to that. And if it's not really, I think this also goes for ideas that the GM or the storyteller, as we say in Vampire, might have, that you can have some kind of a magical GM idea that's running some kind of great explanation about how all things connect together. But if that doesn't come up in the game, then it, in my mind, doesn't exist in the game. I don't really believe in that. If it comes up in the game, then it exists in the game, and then it's part of it. but before that, it's only potentials.
I think it's summarized quite well by the... It's often used in movies to describe how people should write their films better. It's just show, not tell. So through action as opposed to through backstory, as you say, or through exposition.
I think that's very true. And now I'm going to talk out of both sides of my mouth a little bit. Sometimes it's very difficult to show the concept that you've written in your backstory. It might be difficult to articulate it, and it might be difficult to demonstrate it through play. And in those cases, I think it's okay to tell other players what you're trying to do. It's okay to turn to the other players and say, the way I've written my character is that she is an amazing rock musician. She's got all these dots in performance. She has a deep knowledge of musical history, and she's performed on stage with some awesome bands. And so what I'm trying to do is demonstrate how awesome a rock musician she is, but I'm having a hard time doing it. Can you help me? Can you help me bring this character to life? Can you do things that help me play off your characters that show that she's a great rock musician? Role-playing games are, I mean, at best, but the best role-playing games are shared story, right? They're collaborative narratives. And I think it's always okay to ask the other players to help you portray the thing that you want in order to have fun together.
Definitely. That also works very well. I first learned that in LARP, because in LARP often you need that. If I'm playing the leader and nobody is like obeying me, then I'm not the leader. So especially those kind of high status characters in LARP, they need to be played up by the other people. But also this works very well in tabletop games for very similar reasons. And I think that when everybody is very generous with each other in kind of playing up each other's characters, then it can enhance. Like playing my character is not only done by me, but it's also done by the other people in the group who kind of play towards me in such a way that my character's nature comes out. And then it's more interesting.
That's a great point, Johanna. I don't think I've ever heard it expressed so well, that players play toward each other in order to support and enable each other's fun. That's awesome.
Yeah, the way you phrased it, that you don't just play your own character, you play someone else's character to a degree by playing it up or down at what they're good at, and having a jibe sometimes maybe at the character who's not good at something, and you know, praising the character who is good at something. So it's not just a case of them rolling dice, and it's not just numbers and successes, it's enthusiasm, and it's in-character praise and condemnation for in-character actions that really enhance everything. I think a really good example of that from Critical Role is, I'm a big fan of Travis.
I do love Travis Willingham's character, right? He's a great example of this in action.
So I'm on about episode 54 of their first campaign, having mostly watched Dice Camera Action recently, because I've only got onto the streaming thing recently because I spent so much time playing. But Travis is great at enhancing the fun of everyone around him. And he's also good at sometimes reining people in when they get a bit too loud, when the GM's trying to speak, but doing it in a non-intrusive way. He's a very good, like almost right-hand man to the GM, in that he helps speed things along when they get slowly by being proactive as a character, or he helps to get people excited by cheering when they roll well. And he's always involved, even when it's in or out of character, in making everyone at the table feel good.
Oh, sure. Travis is a master at that. And I think he sets a great example for all players, regardless of the game system, right? He's developed a very specific character voice and stance. He describes his actions, but briefly, so that it doesn't, you know, unnecessarily take the spotlight away from other people. And it's clear that he and Matthew have worked out a really tight level of agency, so that Travis doesn't have to make any assumptions. He can just move into great descriptions and set boundaries that are clearly delineating the fun. And then Matthew, of course, because their relationship is so tight, he just goes with what, you know, Travis is saying, unless it really goes against the plan, of course, and then it's trouble for everybody.
Yes, and I absolutely love what he does when he plays up his character's flaws and his character's negatives in a hilarious way.
Oh, it's wonderful. I think everybody, every member in that cast does this something similar, but in a very different, unique way. The way in which Taliesin plays his characters in a way that gives Matt so much material to work
with. Yeah, you can tell that that's a player who converses with his GM for hours about the game outside of the game. He's
sure,
very
absolutely.
Excited, even when he's not yeah. playing.
Taliesin was one of the playtesters in V5 with me, and you know, he taught me some things about the Tremere that I didn't consider when we were writing it, and that was awesome.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite things Travis's Grog did that really made me clap and point to that is a good player was the scene when he's purchasing things from a traveling merchant and he negotiates. And he negotiates a higher price than was originally presented and thinks he's done a really good job. And everybody's going to be really proud of him. And the players at the table are out of character, sat there going, no. No, don't do that. Don't do that. And he's thinking, like, I'm doing it.
And yet.
Yeah. And then it comes back 20 odd episodes later when they meet the same merchant. And they're like, right, you fleeced him. And they get a whole extra scene out of it.
It's brilliant. I think that relates at least orthogonally to a concept that actually Johanna introduced me to with End of the Line. And that is, playing to lose, which is a very popular philosophical standpoint for role-playing games and LARPs, less common in America, although growing in popularity. What do you think about that, Johanna? I mean, playing to lose is a time-honored tradition.
Of Cthulhu players everywhere.
Yeah, Cthulhu players, but also in free-form LARPs everywhere. And I think that can really inform tabletop play as well.
I think that Cthulhu kind of comparison is a good one because at least in my scene and sort of my circles, discussion of it came much later. But when you think about the idea, it was already in there in some form. Because when I think about my first, when I, as a player, as a LARPer, first sort of got an idea of what you could do with that concept, was actually quite early. When I was something like 16 or 17, I was playing my very first Vampire LARP campaign, and my character was killed. And I had an absolutely wonderful death scene. And after that, I thought, that was great. I loved that. That was like a great LARP scene. I had a lot of fun with that scene. And I thought, but I also died. Like, that was also a thing that happened. So I very much lost because I lost my character. But then I thought that it's not so bad because I still had a very good LARP experience. At that point, I wasn't smart enough to kind of conceptualize it. But in later years, when there was... In the Nordic LARP scene, there was a lot of discussion about this concept of play to lose. So sort of driving yourself on purpose into bad situations just to see, because they might be more interesting, or taking risks that are kind of unadvisable, but also lead to more interesting things. And I think it's, we can call it play to lose, or maybe call it something like just not trying to win, but playing towards something that's interesting. And
I call it embracing failure.
We call it relish the botch at Manchester's Gaming Society. Relish the botch, because some of your most memorable moments will come from the failures, not the successes.
That's great. I think that kind of way of describing embracing failure is awesome.
And when I think about specifically Vampire, which we worked on with Jason, I think with Vampire it goes really well. When you think, for example, that let's say that my anarch character is at the Elysium. Would it be smart to try to hit on a Venture Welder? Probably that would be a very bad idea, because even if it succeeded, it would still... Even if it succeeded, it would still be bad.
Yeah, let's use the Toreador Primogen as a human shield.
Yeah, but...
That would never happen. I don't know what you mean.
See what happens. It can lead to interesting things.
So I think the whole winning and losing aspect is an interesting one to explore, because I find that a lot of players who come to roleplay have previously played video games or board games a lot, and there is a win condition in those games. And in Dungeons & Dragons a lot of time, there's a win condition, and that's the most well-known game, and the win condition is defeat the big bad guy at the end of the campaign. Whereas I think when you get past that, and when you get deeper into roleplay games, there is no winning and losing. Winning is just having a good time, because people who... I've heard the phrase, how do you win, when people ask me about roleplay? And I say, well, there isn't winning and losing. It's a narrative experience. You come and you have fun and you tell a story together. And as long as you've felt something or you've had a time at the end of it, that's the goal. There isn't a win condition. The game isn't just over at a magical point. It's over when you fill a narrative arc. And then you start a new narrative arc or a new game.
I agree with you. I'm going to disagree with you a little bit. I don't think that there... I think you mentioned Dungeons and Dragons having very clear winning conditions.
Oh, it can be. Not it does.
Of course it can. And so can Vampire, Call of Cthulhu, Shadowrun, or any other role-playing game. But I think that as we've talked about streaming, I think that one of the things to marvel at about streaming is that it's shown us all that fun is the victory in Dungeons and Dragons and role-playing games. Satine Phoenix, a good friend of mine, runs some wonderful tabletop D&D games on stream, Sirens of the Realms, for example, and it is very clear from her storytelling technique and her skill that the only victory condition is fun. And when everybody has a good time and comes away from the game sorry that it's over and ready to play again and eager for more, that's victory. That's the win. She's a master at it. And I think that now more than ever, you know, we are experiencing a renaissance in the idea that everybody, adults included, have permission to have fun. We have license to enjoy the shared narrative and the collaborative story, even when we lose, as Johanna was talking about. And that's revolutionary. And I don't know where it's going to take us, but I like the look of it.
I think in terms of losing, one of the pieces of advice is I would maybe give players is that it's okay to feel sad or upset when your character dies, but, you know, feel those things and then reflect on what a good time you had playing them, what good scenes they had, and then think of just what you're going to do next as well, because it doesn't mean it's the end. It's not the end of the game for you. It's not the end of the game for the group. It's not the end of the game, full stop.
Oh, heavens no, and especially in a game like Vampire, death is not necessarily a career-ending injury.
The vast majority of my vampire characters have, in fact, been killed by other player characters. A lot of our vampire games end like Reservoir Dogs.
Oh my.
Everybody kills each other because something goes wrong or some betrayal is found out. Vampire is a game where I think the setting, you can be very collaborative, but you can also tell incredible stories where there is conflict between the player characters. But I think that requires a very good, mature group. PvP is a very fast road to people falling out or being upset or angry if it's not been discussed, it's not been established, and you don't know how people react to it. What are your thoughts on PvP?
Player versus player? You mean
player versus player? No, as in when player characters, there's conflict within the party, not just without, and that sometimes it can result in in-character violence, not out-of-character violence. Obviously, that's unacceptable.
That's a complicated question. I'm gonna think about that for a minute, and I'll let Johanna answer first, because I have to think about that.
Unfortunately, this is not a question that's easy for me to answer, because in my role playing career, I haven't had a lot of experience with that kind of games. Almost all of the games I've played in or ran have been very kind of collaborative in how the characters approach each other. So there's not a lot of, there can be kind of social drama, but not characters literally attacking each other. Very, very few cases. So I'm not an expert on that at all.
Oh, fine. Okay. So
it's all on you, Jason.
You're a big help. You know that, right? So it's a fine question, and it's a complicated question. I can only speak from my own experience. When I run a tabletop role-playing game, regardless of what it is, I always run a session zero, like I mentioned at the start of the podcast. And that's the session where we all sit down and talk about what we want and what's fun. And one of the questions I always ask my players, whether it's a live-action role-playing game or a tabletop game, or even sometimes board games, because these days board games are crossing boundaries between LARP and board and tabletop RPG styles.
I heard there's a Vampire the Masquerade board game. We'll talk about that later.
There is one that's been announced. And I always ask, how do you feel about player versus player? What is fun for you? Do you want this game to allow, condone, encourage, reward, or punish player versus player? Is it okay to harm another character? I think that it's really important to let the group have that discussion. I usually leave the room for that discussion. I set the question in motion, and then I go get a cup of coffee or go outside to you know, take a stroll or whatever. Let them talk about it without me first. And then I come back and ask them what consensus have they reached. And I find that the times where I don't do that is where we're all sorry. Some players really thrive on competitive play. And that means proving that they are better, superior to, smarter than other players, not characters, but players, or better than or smarter than the game master. That's okay. And that has to be okay, because that's as viable a way to play as any other. But you don't telegraph that. If you don't state that this is what you are here at the table for, and this is part of a game, part of the game that makes you excited to play, you're going to be sorry. So as long as that's discussed and understood between other players and the storyteller at the beginning, I think you're all right.
Agreed. I've seen it go really, really well, and I've seen it go really, really badly. And it's almost always down to communications and desires of players and what's going to upset
people. Absolutely. I think that when it goes badly, there's probably been no initial discussion, and people feel somehow that the unspoken social contract at the table has been violated. This isn't what they came here for. This isn't fun for them, and they get upset about it. I'm okay with PvP personally. I'm all right with competition. I'm happy to play nerd football, no problem. But or whatever you want to call it. But I want to talk about it first, and I want to find out what other people's boundaries are, and I want to be respectful of those. If the other players at the table don't want to engage in that, I'm not going to do it. I don't want to make anybody uncomfortable. And if you do make someone uncomfortable at the table, I think you ought to apologize, talk to them about it, and then learn from it.
Yeah, one thing I wonder about there, which kind of leads into a point we wanted to discuss, is how important is it for the player to know the system? So, for example, a game I played at this year's Nationals, which is it's
a competitive role-playing event.
It is a competitive role-playing event. But, you know, I went in, it was my first time actually role-playing at it instead of playing board games. And one of the games we played there was Paranoia. And that is a game that thrives on player versus player.
It's like,
because you have six lives to waste. Yeah.
It's the definition of the game, really.
Yeah. So, I mean, is that how much of it, I suppose maybe how much of the onus is on a player there to know the system beforehand? And how much is it maybe on the DM or the storyteller to explain to the players kind of what they should be expecting?
That especially in the case of player versus player games, at least it sounds to me like it would create a bad situation if there's a lot of discrepancy between skill levels of players and how they understand the system. But in a less competitive game, like in my experience, the main thing what I want from the players is that they kind of understand what the system sort of does and what's its purpose and what these rules do. Like and why we have them, especially things like in Cthulhu, it would be the sanity system, or in V5, the hunger dice, like these very key mechanics and how those work. But when I run a game, I don't require the players really to know the details of the rules. I can explain them, but at the same time, I'm usually quite happy if there's at least like one or two players who know the system being used very well, because then it's not only on me to explain it, but also, like, let's say that I'm running a thing with one or two players, then the two others can talk about like system questions between each other. like that kind of thing can happen during the game if I'm not the only one who knows it. So for that reason, I usually appreciate it if there is somebody who knows the system present beyond me.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely always, at least I've found running D&D, there's normally one player who will read, who have read more books than I have.
Yeah, it's normally one player who'll correct you.
Well, yeah, and that's fine. Like, I'm happy to be corrected if I've got something significantly wrong. So depending on what it is, I'll sometimes just roll with it for a roll. But yeah, having those players who have got the time sometimes to read all the books when I haven't had the chance is really helpful, I find.
That being said, nobody likes a complete rules lawyer. A GM needs room to wiggle, room to interpret, room to change things as they see fit. And a player who tries to insist that the GM is wrong and that they should be doing it a certain way can become a problem if not spoken to. And that can extend to settings. I know one of the best GMs I've ever met, but he refuses, despite being a huge Star Wars fan, to ever run a Star Wars game. Because he says he absolutely knows that someone at the table will start correcting him on elements of lore that he's got wrong. And it will just frustrate him.
Well, again, I say ironically, that would never happen, right?
Well, they appear to be correcting the filmmakers at the minute, so
Sure, but role-playing games aren't a film, right?
Exactly.
They're not a television show. They're not a novel. They're not defined by they're not defined by scripts. They're not defined by pages and covers. They're open. They're collaborative. They're fast-changing and they're free-flowing. I think that if you do know a game system, it's awesome to have you at the table because you probably know what your character's boundaries are, their limitations. You can figure out what is the rough odds of a particular action succeeding or failing, just like in real life, right? You can make quick assessments of situations and figure out how to act quickly because you understand how the rules are defined, how the world is defined as written. New players, they get a pass here because they don't know the rules yet. But and again, I'm going to cite the session zero. For some players, playing according to the strict interpretation of the rules is where the fun is. That's what's fun for them. Finding a way to defeat scenarios or to be clever enough to prick their way out of danger according to the rules as written is where they derive their joy.
You change the rules from rules as written without making it clear, those players can find it very frustrating that things aren't working the way they expected to and planned.
Absolutely, because their expectations, are different. I mean, disappointment is the gap between reality and expectation. It's been said by people a lot smarter than me, but I think it's true. And the same is true at tabletop role playing games as well. And those are the type of players who are the most likely to become what you called a rules lawyer. And I think if you're arguing about a rule for more than 30 seconds, probably not good for the game or your fellow players. There's no health and safety inspector in role-playing games, right?
Unless you're playing a health and safety inspector.
Right? That'd be interesting.
Malkavian health and safety inspector.
Yeah, okay. We're going to do that game next. That's official. But, Matthew Mercer isn't going to come to your house and berate you for getting a D&D rule wrong.
If that's how I got him here, I would be getting those rules wrong.
Wow.
If that was like the summon Matt Mercer spell.
Okay. Yeah, you have weird priorities, but we'll talk about that later. But the point is that sometimes the rules are wrong because they interfere with fun. And in those situations, the game master must be empowered to make a ruling or make a decision in favor of fun. And if that isn't satisfying to you as a player, I don't think you should leave the game, but you might want to find a different group.
Have you seen this porn?
That's amazing.
Oh my goodness. That's awesome. A little too true to life, but yeah, it's awesome.
To read it out loud and give credit where it's due. I don't know, that summoning method seems a little mercenary.
Oh.
Superb. Super.
I can't audibly facepalm, but I can try.
Oh my goodness. But yeah.
This is what you get when you have an actual live audience. It's great.
Really true. I think you'll see the same thing in the V5 streaming chronicle that we do. We're gonna make rulings that might not necessarily, be the rules as written, but they're going to be because that's more interesting and fun for the outcome.
Because they enhance the game, the scene, the experience, or the narrative. All of those things.
Unquestionably.
So I do like to say to new people, though, who are often put off by these big rule books and these new systems, I'm going to be running a D&D 5th edition game for my girlfriend's friends who've never roleplayed before this weekend.
Awesome.
And I like to say to new players that you don't need to know the system at all. You just need to have some ideas and be willing to talk, and then the GM can tell you what to roll. You say, I want to do this, the GM can tell you how likely that's going to be and what to roll. Knowledge just comes with experience.
Are you asking us to tell you if that's cool? Because that's cool.
I'm sorry.
That sounds good. Sounds great.
I think that's an excellent way to explain it.
The last question before we move straight on to V5 and White Wolf is that, as a game designer, how do you encourage the kind of play that you want to see from players in the game mechanics and or text?
Yeah, I think there's two ways to approach it. And one is to kind of hard code things into the game mechanics. And I think this is a kind of a commonly accepted good practice to do so, that the things you want to happen in the game, you code in the game mechanics, as has been done in V5, for example, with the hunger mechanic. And you can achieve great things with that. But I have to say that sometimes I like also the much simpler way of just like writing, do this, play like this. So instead of kind of making it into coding it into game mechanics, you just write straight instructions and hope that people actually do as they say. Because sometimes I think it helps people a lot when you explain why something is designed like it is, so that they understand the intent behind it. Because when they do that, they kind of start to collaborate with it, and then they use it. They kind of become enabled to use it in a more proactive way. And I think that's why I'm a big fan of those sections that often are in a role-playing game book at the back of the book, where there's kind of GM advice, and then like how to run this game, you do this and you do that, and it's just a straight explanation. I think you can code a lot of information in that way too, just straight up telling people. Although it's less
demystify it. Just state it plainly. Rule number one: don't be.
I'm not saying you can't do it with mechanics. Obviously, you can. We do it all the time with mechanics, but it's not the only way to do it, I think. But
do you find that mechanics can be used to reward and punish behaviors?
I'm more of a fan of kind of not thinking it in terms of rewarding or punish, but okay. More that
encourage kind of or discourage.
Encourage, yeah. I think in V5, the messy critical is a great example of this kind of encouraging method, where if your hunger dice come up the wrong way, you get a result where you succeed, but you succeed in a kind of a beast vampire kind of way. And I think that's a great mechanic for encouragement, because it is success. You feel like, yes, I succeeded. But at the same time, there's obviously like a huge negative thing, both in terms of who your character is and in terms of the personality, but possibly also for game events. If you accidentally kill somebody, that's going to be a problem. And I think that's a great way of great mechanic for enabling and encouraging.
So to see if I understand this mechanic correctly, because it's a mechanic that I'm very interested in, I've been trying to explain to some seasoned Vampire the Masquerade veterans. You would, instead of blood points now, you'd accumulate hunger dice for every day that you're not fed or certain powers that you've used. You're getting hungry. These dice represent that. And if you roll certain numbers on these... Is it not? Okay. And if you roll certain numbers on these dice, you may succeed in an unpleasant or a more monstrous way. So a very simple explanation might be, instead of trying to open the door in a hurry, you actually rip the whole door off because there's just that more monstrous, feral side starting to get out.
I think that's a really good shorthand. It's obviously it's more nuanced and can be more complicated than that, but that's a very good brief way to describe it. We did get rid of the blood pool.
I was wrong about how you accumulate the hunger dice. How are the hunger dice going to be accumulated?
So you can accumulate hunger dice in a number of different ways. And again, the rules tell you how to scale this for the taste of your table, right? If you want to have hunger be less of a focus, we include some suggestions. If you want to have it be more of a focus, we include some other suggestions. But the default way to do it is that every time that you're a vampire, whenever you choose to step outside mortality and be a monster, you risk hunger. You don't automatically accumulate hunger dice ever. It's always a risk. So whenever you call upon the power of your blood to enhance your strength or your intelligence or your charisma, whenever you flood your undead body with a blush of life to appear human, whenever you power certain disciplines, whenever you solve problems in the way that a monster solves problems and not the way a human does, you risk increasing your hunger. You roll a die and you rouse the blood, you tempt the monster, and if the dice come up a certain result, you gain hunger. Eventually, your hunger dice accumulation becomes so great that you need to deal with that hunger. You can't avoid it. So the hunger system is really it's really gambling. It's really a risk-reward engine that encourages you to think about how far can I push my hunger tonight? How hungry can I afford to get or I have to deal with it. What monstrous things am I willing to risk in order to achieve my goals in the short term that I might have to pay for in the long term by feeding on blood? That is our answer to the problem that Vampire the Masquerade, we think, has always posed. For 27 years, Vampire has always told us as a game that vampires are predators, that they hunt for blood, and that that struggle of humanity versus the beast, as expressed through blood hunger, is the central point of the game. But the mechanics didn't always pay off that idea as completely as people might have wanted.
I agree with that. I never thought as clearly about it as I did until I read some of the notes going into V5.
Thank you. We looked back at first edition for that premise, and we found that in every edition of the game, the premise is the same, but the rules don't match the mythology. So we essentially reverse engineered. We started with the mythology. What does the story tell us is true about a vampire? And we tried to build rules around it. Karim Muammar and Carl Bergstrom pioneered that system, and they did some pretty heavy-duty thinking around it very early that created the basis for the hunger system. And now what you've got is this game of this multi-leveled game of, it's almost a Vegas-style roulette wheel or craps or poker, really. It's poker. And you're measuring risk versus reward. You are gauging your hunger versus your willpower versus your humanity, trying to figure out how much you're willing to risk in all three dimensions in order to get what you want without paying the consequences. But because you're a vampire, you will sometime, maybe not tonight, but another night, you will pay those consequences. The beast will come to the fore. It will get free of its cage. It will do terrible things. And you will have to decide how you deal with that. And so the hunger system is our way of trying to reinforce the fundamental pathos of being a vampire, but in a way that's fun at the table. It's fun to play that game of chicken with the hunger dice. It's fun to play risk and reward and spin the roulette wheel and see if you can come out the winner. And it's fun to fail.
And I love where you've gone with it, because when we talked about how you mechanically describe things or how you mechanically encourage things versus describing them literally, as you've said, in previous editions of Vampire, it was always a theme, but you had to choose to engage with the theme. You could, if you chose to, it would be the way I would choose to play Vampire, you could choose to ignore some of those themes or ignore some of the consequences or play down the consequences of having lower humanity in favour of just playing a power fantasy. And power fantasy is one way to play a game, and it's a great way to play a game. But I love that the consequences are being mechanically ingrained in a way that makes it hard to ignore. In the fact that your choices have consequences, even if you aren't intending them, it's in the game, and you can't choose not to engage with that anymore. Really,
I think I could put it more. I don't think I could put it better myself. Actually, I'm gonna use your explanation from now on. That was awesome. It was great. It took me 5 minutes. It took you 30 seconds. That's great.
Yeah, I think that's exciting. That's where implementing things mechanically that encourage what you want to see can create the gameplay you want to create and the environments and scenes you want to create without people having to find their own way to create it. It's already built in. And Tom mentioned Fate System earlier. Have either of you played much Fate System?
Yeah.
Unfortunately not.
So I played some Dresden Files, and one of the things I liked about that character creation system was that it encouraged you to think of personality traits more than skills, because you could barter with the GM around the personality traits. And you needed negative ones as well, like curiosity could be seen as a negative one, because the GM could offer you points that you spend on things in order to go and trigger the trait. So the GM could say, you're curious, and tip you a little point. And you can choose to take it or not take it, but then you can use the point later to alter a scene. So it encourages you to think of how the GM hooks your character into a scene and how to make it easy for the GM, because the GM rewards you for it, and the game rewards you for it. And that's one way that mechanics can really encourage the play you want to see.
They've taken that even further in the little newer edition since Dresden Files, which where they're encouraging you for every single aspect to think about how it can be a good and a bad thing. Like, and it really helps as a DM to have that kind of laid out for you.
Like, you can say, I'm quick to anger, so I'm going to get a bonus to this first roll. The GM could also, at some point, say, you're quick to anger, so you're going to start a fight. even if you didn't intend to. And you can choose to accept or not accept, but there's this almost little currency that goes back and forth, allowing people to alter scenes, which is really interesting, encouraging to think about their character and how they're going to give the GM a way to give them those points. And it, once again, it's mechanically a way to encourage certain elements of gameplay and character creation, the same you've done with Hunger System. You are mechanically implementing something you wish to see that people can't just swerve around. I think it's great.
It's difficult to swerve around it. You can if you're really determined.
Oh, you could just get rid of the dice altogether and completely freeform.
Get rid of the dice. It wouldn't be hard to reverse engineer, but we think that the best way to support the themes of Vampire the Masquerade, the themes we've all loved for a long time, is to really, really swing the spotlight over to hunger as a really fun aspect of the humanity versus beast struggle. And really lean into that as the
it's
as
one the of the main drivers for the beast.
It always has been, right?
That's what the beast does.
Sure. The beast basically wants to be the only vampire in the world, and it wants all the blood. It doesn't want to tolerate other predators, other rivals. It wants to be the only predator, and it wants to do exactly as it pleases when it wants to.
And when I thought about it as well as a system, I thought of how easy it is to transfer to the other White Wolf IPs. The same system can be used for Rage in Werewolf. It could be used for Paradox in Mage. It's really fluid, and it translates into all of these themes mechanically quite well.
It could.
It might not. We'll have to see in future. But when I gave it some thought, I realized what a good system you've hit on with this.
That's interesting speculation right there.
Oh, it's really purely speculation. Is. I have no insight into this, and I actually love it.
You don't say.
This may or may not happen in the future. It is Schrödinger's system.
I was changing the subject the other day, and I was saying.
I mean, moving on into talking about 5e fully, as a segue, I mean, from what we've been talking about, do we want to talk about what makes a good character in Vampire the Masquerade, but specifically 5th edition?
We talked about this earlier in the podcast, but Vampire the Masquerade and V5 in particular is a game about relationships. It's a moral game about immoral monsters, and they all have relationships to one another, to the other vampires around them, to the human beings in the city, and to special human beings that keep them connected to whatever is left of their humanity. And because it is a game about relationships, I think that what makes a good Vampire the Masquerade character is a persona that has a lot of very strong opinions and feelings about those relationships. You don't have to have a lot of relationships numerically, but you do have to have feelings about them and opinions. Vampire emotions are often exaggerated. They love and they hate deeper than humans because they're vampires.
I think it helps with when you create the vampire character for V5 to have a character who really has all these vampire desires and motivations that drive them towards other people, because that way then you can just follow those things in game. And these things are fairly well mechanically supported also in the game, but it's also a question of mentality. Like for me, one I think a very good vampire question is like, who would be the people who could convince me to or motivate me to do things that are like possibly very strongly against my own interest? And this could be something very kind of classic vampire stuff, like the your old lover from your mortal days, who you or something like that. And then there could be a story strand related to that, which will suddenly make you take all those risks that are very risky, but also that generate magnificent game.
So speaking of relationships with NPCs and when you build characters, I do think it's always a good idea for players to create NPCs and families and people that they care about in order to, for the GM to leverage. Too many times I think I've seen players say, oh, well, I don't want to give them anyone they're close to because then you'll kill them.
Sure, but that's a different kind of fun, right? And Vampire 5th edition, V5 assumes that you will create those connections. In fact, it's a required part of character creation. The humanity system in Vampire the Masquerade 5th edition is very different from previous humanity systems. In all other previous editions, it was assumed that all vampires around the world, regardless of what culture they were from or background, all shared the same moral code. and it was based on a hierarchy of sins, negative actions, on a scale of 1 to 10. And no matter where the vampire originated from, the scale was the same. So, you know, arson was always a certain level of sin or bad action on the chart. Murder, property damage, whatever. And it created some very, very, it created fun play, but it had some pretty significant limitations. What we chose to do in V5 is look at some very modern RPG design techniques. And we decided that humanity was dependent on individual belief. So when you create your V5 character, you decide on a number of beliefs. You decide on a number of lines in the sand that your character will not cross. Maybe you don't murder. Maybe you don't steal. Maybe you don't lie. Maybe it's family before all things. Maybe it's my country, right or wrong. Whatever it is, that belief, that concept, that moral imperative is your humanity. Because people around the world are incredibly individualistic about what they believe and how they define their morality and their humanity. People from different cultures define a good life in very different ways. And we wanted our vampires to reflect the world more as it is that way. The second step of the humanity system is to take those beliefs and create touchstones. Touchstones are mortals who reflect, embody those beliefs. Maybe one of your touchstones is that loyalty before death. That's an amazing concept, right? Loyalty above all things.
Tremendous.
You might then create a mortal character, a touchstone, to reflect that belief. Maybe it's a family member. Maybe it's a member of your street gang who went to jail because he refused to snitch on his comrades. Maybe it's a member of the clergy who embodies deep loyalty against terrible odds. Whatever it is, that mortal keeps you connected to your belief in your humanity. When that mortal is threatened in some way, your humanity could be stained. You might have to work really hard to clean it. And yes, of course, it's the storyteller's role to endanger your touchstone, to present you with challenges that are going to threaten that mortal and for you to address and overcome. That's the conceit of the game. If you're concerned that that is not a fun way to play, that's fine. There's no pejorative there. But that isn't Vampire. It's never been Vampire, and it isn't Vampire 5th edition at all. The World of Darkness is not a nice place, and people we care about get endangered. That's not the issue. The issue is how we deal with those challenges. Do we rise to them and confront them and overcome them and maybe learn something about ourselves and our world? Or do we let it slide? Do we let harm come to those we love and care about, and in so doing, endanger our very souls? That's the drama.
I love it. I love it because, to me, you are codifying. You're codifying into the game ideas and concepts that I think a lot of good GMs and role players already use, but a lot of new ones don't know how to yet. And
I think that
one thing that got said to me when I ran Vampire, because it's a very different kind of game, someone who'd mostly played Shadowrun and Dungeons & Dragons with a very different kind of GM, was that I'd changed the way they approached their character, and that they'd started more thinking about who their character is and what they want and how they feel than what they're capable of in terms of skills and abilities. And skills and abilities are cool, superpowers are cool, but to me what's interesting is who they are, what they believe, what they're willing to do, and what drives them. And you're putting that into the game as standard. Is who do you care about, what do you care about, and how can the GM use that to involve you in the story? There's no arbitrary, oh, well, I'm involved in this story because I'm a player. There's levers to pull for everybody to make things happen.
Not only are there levers for the storyteller to pull, but there are levers for other characters to pull. Johanna ran what for me was one of the best role-playing game experiences of my life in Berlin last year. It was a live-action role-playing game based on V5 called Enlightenment in Blood. And each of the characters there had levers to pull with one another that led to incredibly intense role-play that I think was very reflective of what we developed in V5.
And I think to tie it into how to be a good player, the best players make the GM's job easy. you give them ways to hook your character and you give them things to use to motivate your character, to make them care about the story. And then it's easy to make your character care. Once your character cares, it's easier for you to care.
Does that work for Anarchs, Johanna? Is that still true and for you rebels on the other side of the political fence?
Yeah, definitely. But actually, I was just thinking about how this because V5 has this element of touchstones, these humans who are important to the vampire character and the vampire character's humanity, because that fear, like which you mentioned earlier, that that player might think that I don't want to create these connections because then they will just get killed and I will be sad. And I think actually there is something to learn in this fear, because this system also places some responsibility on the storyteller in how to use these touchstones and how to use these vulnerabilities these characters have in a way that's good game. Because sometimes the game can be interesting if indeed something really horrible happens to those characters and then all player characters are very sad. But other times it can be very different. Like, let's say that your touchstone is that old high school sweetheart. But then it turns out that through events in the campaign, that high school sweetheart finds out about vampires. Maybe she wants to be a vampire. Maybe she turns up at Elysium and suddenly you're in a very different situation. You're trying to hold on to your lost humanity and the innocence of your youth, while at the same time your touchstone is running wild, trying to become a toreador.
Maybe she thinks it's romantic and she doesn't see the monstrosity underneath it.
Yeah, definitely. Like that. Suddenly, it's not at all about like the storyteller killing off characters for cheap tragedy, but it's a very different kind of drama that nevertheless generates a lot of action in the game. And I think that kind of thinking can get a lot of value out of all of these human elements without making it like a horrible tragedy every time.
Not everybody has to be kidnapped.
No, yeah, not everybody has to be kidnapped.
Well, I mean, yeah, you can certainly play the Dark Knight plot device.
Sometimes they can be kidnapped, definitely.
But not everything is a Scandi thriller.
No, not at all. And it's not everything is a Quentin Tarantino thriller either, right?
Yeah, not everything is Reservoir Dogs, despite my experience.
Sometimes your touchstones aren't endangered through any kind of physical problem. Sometimes it's a moral issue or an emotional issue. Or even a mental issue. The number of ways in which humans can be endangered that creates drama is limited only by the imagination of the players and the storytellers. It doesn't have to be physical harm.
And a core rule of story is that conflict is required for story to be driven, because without conflict, there's no resolution. So there needs to be conflict, but it doesn't have to be physical or violent conflict. It can be emotional or political.
Sure, it can be religious, it can be philosophical. Those things are no less distressing than the threat of violence.
That's one thing I really like about the touchstones, is that they are like most definitely human. So it means that they are prone to, like, they're not going to sit there and just wait for your character to have the character's drama. Instead, they're going to do stuff on their own, which could be totally human stuff, but still like relevant. And I think that could create interesting dichotomies. Let's say that your character is on an epic kind of mission to become the prince of the city, and we have all these high-level vampire politics. But at the same time, the humanity of the character is dependent on the character's grandmother. And the grandmother has been, I don't know, has a new boyfriend who's like 90, and there's some kind of old age home drama, and suddenly you have to play these two levels, this big political story affecting the fate of the city, and then this very small human story of all these old people and their lives, and you kind of have to do the latter too, because otherwise if you lose connection to your humanity, then you don't have anything anymore.
Yeah, it's great. I want to play in your game, Johanna. This is awesome.
Well, so do I. So you've got two volunteers. When are we running?
Yeah, it's going to be all about the old people's home. That's what we're going to do.
Yeah, I'm all for it. Every game of yours, Johanna, that I've ever played in, I have come away loving and wanting more. So sign me up.
That is very kind.
You can, if you're creative enough, you can make any setting absolutely enthralling. Really, it depends on the player, the group, the GM, and and what you're willing to do, think of, and how outrageous you're willing to be, or how grand
it does take creativity. It also takes buy-in. It also takes a willingness to go there together.
Absolutely.
To give each other the benefit of the doubt, and also to read in good faith, to presume that everybody's intentions at the table are good, and that everybody is there to have fun and enhance the enjoyment of everybody else. And if you start from that position, I think your fun is going to be enhanced. I really do.
So you listed one of these questions, Tom, that you wanted to ask, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yeah. So as Mike mentioned earlier, I played in his game, and that was my first experience with World of Darkness. We played for a year and a half.
But you can be honest. Was it awesome?
Yeah, I know. I enjoyed myself. But
Empire cried when it...
Yeah.
We had a check.
Yeah, the story was good. I had a bit of a problem at the start where I used to travel a lot for my old job. So I missed some of the kind of like cool stuff. So I was kind of playing catch up for a while, which kind of led to me developing a character who was a bit kind of dazed and confused, which worked quite well since he was newly a new vampire, you know, neonate. But so one thing I didn't really have, I understood, I'd heard about people talking about World of Darkness. I knew it was a darker game. I knew it was a bit more political. But one thing I didn't really have a handle on was the lore, and I thought that was a good thing. Like, I'm a neonate, I'm learning about the world, and that's fine. But now that I've played it and would like to probably run it in the future, learning the lore is something that I want to do. And Mike sent me a video, the first episode of The Gentleman's Guide the other day, and I found that was yeah. excellent. Yeah, that was so good. I mean, it really sets the scene.
Well, I watched all of his older ones as well. And I'm really glad he's doing them for V5. And I was pleasantly surprised when I saw that he had a spot writing some of the material, because he knows the lore very well. He very good material he's put out in the past as a fan.
Oh sure, Matthew has an encyclopedic knowledge of the lore. He was one of the main contributors to the book Beckett's Jihad Diary, which is essentially it's the story bridge between the previous editions of Vampire the Masquerade and V5. And Matthew is uniquely qualified to deliver in-character opinions about what's happening in the game world that may or may not be 100% accurate.
Is that something that's going to continue, by the way, the writing of books from the perspective of characters? In fact, because that is one of the best things about the old lore, was that a lot of it was not set in stone and was debatable, and that a lot of things were told from the perspective of the characters.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, definitely. This is... kind of my main contribution so far has been to write most of the Anarch book, and in those books, the Camarilla book and the Anarch book, the voices are very much like in-game voices, or the voices of characters who live in this world, because to me that creates the opportunity to highlight all these differences of opinion and ideology and worldview between all of these factions. And especially, I think when it comes to vampire history, I think the only thing you can really, like how do you even know anything? Because everything that you hear is just the opinion of some old vampire.
You can say the same thing about real history.
Definitely, you can say the same thing about real history, but vampire history is even worse in the sense that because of the masquerade, there are very few actual physical sources of evidence, so the vampire can't take a trip to the archives to see if it's really true. They just have to trust the views of some ancient being who probably lies all the time.
He's probably just lying, yeah, or at least distorting facts,
or even sometimes intentionally.
Yeah, I have a little story about lore. And Matthew Dawkins also plays a little part in it, because when I was hired for V5 to write for it, I was quite confident in my sort of lore expertise, because I had done all these vampire LARPs. I had played vampire since like 95. I've read a lot of the books, but so I had the feeling that I know what I need to know to do this. And then I got on the team, I joined the Slack, and started reading some of the stuff other people had written, and I looked at the Anarch book production plan and all that, and I very, very, very quickly realized that actually I don't know what I need to know. and then I was very, very happy that Matthew helped me out a little, because I realized I need to start reading really fast. So I started reading all these vampire books that I hadn't read before. And Matthew was suggesting more material for me to read. Like to write about this, you need to read that. And I had a kind of a writing routine that every morning I wake up, I read some of the books, then I start writing. Because I think that when you are dealing with this kind of a shared world, as the World of Darkness is, I think it's even if we are updating the material, it's still important to kind of get it right, that I have to know what I'm doing.
Do you find a writer at all, it's hard not to step on toes elsewhere, in that, like, World of Darkness has, without a lot of people knowing it, heavily influenced vampire mythos in pop culture. Especially when you look at things like the Underworld films, you know, where there was a lot of furore at certain periods.
It's funny you should say that, because there's a documentary film called The World of Darkness Documentary that is just now being released worldwide on various streaming platforms that talks about that very topic. It's an independent film made by an independent film company, and they decided that the story of the World of Darkness and its influence on modern vampire popular culture was interesting enough to make a film about. And so depending on where you are in the world, you can already see the World of Darkness documentary on different streaming platforms. It's coming to North America, I believe, September 18th on a number of different platforms. The influence is very clear. It's very easy to see. But the short answer to your question is no. No, we don't answer. We don't worry about stepping on those toes. We have a story to tell. We have a narrative mission, and we have a lot of very clear goals for telling stories in the World of Darkness. And we assume that it will influence others. We hope it will influence others. And I think it's better that we just tell those stories and, you know, see what other people do with them and how they're inspired by them.
Definitely. I think that the World of Darkness has a kind of a depth of nuance and history and kind of detail and a richness of ideas that to me is unparalleled, like in this field. Like, there are a lot of other things also, other TV series and movies and so on that exist in this sort of similar space and deal with similar ideas. But I don't think there is really anything else that goes quite this deep and with this kind of coherence of vision.
Well, I think that's evidenced by the kind of people who used to ring up Travis Williams, somehow getting his phone number and asking where the original Book of Nod was.
Yes, indeed.
I suspect knowing Travis, he has a definitive answer for you.
Well, I think the point I'm trying to make is that people, the World of Darkness is so well written and it's so interlinked with various historical events that if people are maybe less mentally sound, they could start to take it seriously. They could start to think, well, what if? It really plays to the conspiracy theory mind, particularly vampire and mage in that way, that if you look at the world through the lens of these books and settings, things make an eerie amount of sense.
Well, I think maybe we'll chalk that up as a testimony to the prescience of the writers. I don't feel that any of us are qualified to make those kind of pronouncements or diagnoses about people.
I'm not a doctor. I just think that if you think you're a Cappadocian for real or a Bali, you maybe want to see someone who is.
I think you're probably right about that.
Is it the Euthanatos book from Mage? Second or revised edition that actually has in the beginning of the book, if you believe that the Euthanatos are a real group or that you are a member of them, please seek help.
Please seek help, sure.
Terrifying that anyone felt the need to put that disclaimer in there.
In our book, V5 has disclaimers in it also. Ours are perhaps of a more serious tone. And the main point of our disclaimer is this. This is a game about monsters. Do not use it as an excuse to be a monster yourself.
I think that's probably a very good disclaimer to make.
We feel very strongly about it, actually.
Absolutely.
On the other hand, if you really do think you're a Euthanatos mage, then, you know, definitely see a professional.
So, community, you know, Johanna, you've been very, very active in building a LARP community. Jason, you are, you know, in charge of building community around Vampyr. How are you going about this, and what is your end goal here? What kind of community are you trying to create, and how big do you want to grow it?
Well, I'm going to answer the last two questions first because they're easy. There is no limit to how big it can get. And we want to make sure that everybody who wants to be part of it and who shares the values of the community can be part of it. So no upper limit on growth. Goals are really easy. We want to create a place where everyone who loves the world of darkness in whatever aspect it may appear in their lives has a place to come, share that love, and feel welcome. Super simple.
I think that if the community around the games is inclusive, and if it's the kind of community that you are that you want to be part of, that community, that it's a positive part of your life, then I think it's been successful, that mission of creating it. At Gen Con, at the White Wolf panel, I had a cheesy line about that. I said that in-game it should be the world of darkness where we explore all these terrible things, but off-game between the players it should be the world of kindness.
I don't think that's cheesy at all, Johanna. That what you said really touched me and moved me, and I think everybody in the room who heard you say it appreciated it, because I think that all too often it's easy to forget that as players, our first responsibility is to be generous and kind with each other, even when you're playing, you know, hideous, nocturnal, blood-sucking marauders that are vampires. I think it's cheesy at all. I think it was a very uplifting thing to say. And I was glad you said it.
Yeah, but that's the kind of community that I want to be a part of. Like, I want to be in a nice community.
Me too. I want to be in a community where people feel free to share the enthusiasm for the thing that they love, and are respectful of the different ways to love it.
And speaking of sharing, I believe there is a portal or tool available for people to share their fan materials.
You are so correct. It's theworldofdarkness.com. It's our community hub. You can do a lot of cool things there right now. You can get the latest V5 news. You can read something like, I don't know, more than 1,000 articles and stories from the classic World of Darkness. You can buy a subscription to a PDF subscription to the World of Darkness back catalog that gives you access to an incredible number of books that you can have online on your phone and read at your leisure. PDFs of V5 and other classic World of Darkness books. You can create Mind's Eye Theater LARP characters. You can watch videos. You can connect with other fans. And very soon, you'll be able to create and store V5 characters online with an interactive character sheet. And we've got, later this year, some other community features for communication and story support that I'll just say that and let the reveal be a surprise.
Well, we'll eagerly look forward to that.
It's a lot of fun. I love going there and looking at the map. When you click on the play button on that site, it brings up this world map, and it puts a little green onk everywhere in the world where someone has registered a World of Darkness tabletop game or live action role playing game, and the map is just full of onks. It's crazy. It's like the world has disappeared under the sea of onks because there are so many people participating in these games worldwide. It's awesome.
So, Johanna, you're writing some of the Anarch material, and we've mentioned that the new sort of conflict is primarily the Camarilla versus the Anarchs. So that's a new dimension to an old conflict.
Yeah, that's kind of like that is the classic conflict when you go back to kind of the roots of Vampire the Masquerade, to the early edition of the War of the Ages. And I think that when we were looking at the setting of this game and how to generate action, how to generate interesting stories, that conflict presented itself as the obvious choice. And I think here it's a question of where are the Anarchs right now and where is the Camarilla right now, and what kind of roles characters might have in these situations. So for both of these organizations are in some way in a state of crisis. And for the anarchs, what it means is that, there's kind of two kinds of anarchs. There's the anarch movement, which is a loosely organized, decentralized political movement of vampires, often young vampires who have a trouble living under the rule of the Camarilla and who are fighting back against Camarilla tyranny. And then you have unbound vampires who maybe want to live a different kind of existence in some place where the anarch movement or the Camarilla doesn't even do anything. But when it comes to these big conflicts, we're specifically talking about the anarch movement. And right now, because of what's happening in the world of vampire, there is the beckoning, which is calling ancient vampires and elders into the Middle East to participate in a war with the Sabbat. And all of that means that the Camarilla is suddenly in a very precarious position, because its power has always been based on the kind of the might, the personal might of all these ancient beings, and suddenly it's in a leadership crisis. That means that the anarchs are slowly realizing that, wait a minute, like the monsters they have been always so afraid of are not there anymore, so they can really start fighting in a big way. So if you play,
so it's sort of what happens when you take Superman away story. Sort of, it's the kingdom come of Vampire the Masquerade.
Yeah, but what it means for anarch characters is that like this is the moment when your character can do things that matter, that have meaning. Like if your characters decide we will now take over that city from the Camarilla, that you have a reasonable, at least some kind of chance of success. It's possible. But at the same time, let's say that you're playing a Camarilla character, what's your situation then? Because of course, from a very broad perspective, these are difficult times for the Camarilla. But on the other hand, there's still, if you are a young vampire in the Camarilla, it looks a little bit different. Because you can think about it like this. The Camarilla used to be ruled by ancient vampires whose understanding of politics, for example, began and ended with like kings and barons and the feudal system. And suddenly those people are supposed to understand the modern intricacies of like a modern democracy. And maybe that's not going to go so well. So there's a lot of opportunities that have been wasted over the years, where young vampires have just been suppressed by the elders and unable to make their mark on the world. But now suddenly, when the situation for the Camarilla has changed, that also means that if you are a young Camarilla vampire, you are on one hand in a very dangerous situation because you are in an organization that's suffering, but on the other hand, you are in a position to make your story, your deeds, your goals be things that matter and really, really impact the world, because you can suddenly take over this legacy that the Camarilla has.
And I think, once again, that's a good fix to what some people perceive perhaps as a problem with later editions of World of Darkness, which was that Vampire especially, sometimes in the grand scheme of things, it felt like player agency was limited by the stifling presence of the elders above them. And in some ways, that was a theme. You know, I mean, Trapped in the Birdcage was a great book about being those people and their position not being all that it seemed. Not Trapped in the Birdcage, what's that called? The Gilded Cage, I think it was.
Gilded Cage, yeah. And as our lead storyteller, Martin Erickson, calls it, the diamond ceiling, right? Beyond which you could not be
less breakable than a glass ceiling.
Right. But suddenly that diamond ceiling is gone. It's shattered. It's removed. And now you have all these young vampires who finally have their shot.
You've got room to move. Yeah.
You do, but it's not always that simple. I think what you're going to see is a lot of elders saying to younger vampires, hey, I have to leave now. Here's my stuff. It better be here when I get back.
Right. And those people might not want to give it back. Yeah.
Think about that for a minute.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite game concepts as well in V5, is that legacy thing.
So with the conflict now centering, or recentering as it used to be, between the Camarilla and the Anarchs, are the Sabbat something that's going to come later? Are they a bit of a mystery right now?
They are a bit of a mystery, and they are going to come later. So both of those things are accurate. But I think in the Camarilla book, there's already some sort of intimations of what might be happening specifically in the Middle East in the Gehenna War. And then that I think that will be very interesting for people to see. And then if we think about what's happened in the world, we think about the rise of the Second Inquisition and all of that, then many of those Sabbat members who are maybe less invested in the Sabbat have also found their way to the Anarchs. Because if you are a cardinal of some major Sabbat city, maybe that's not what you do. But if you are a pack of normal Sabbat shovel heads somewhere, then joining the great Anarch revolution might look to be very attractive.
It'd be really cool. There's a lot of fluidity and dynamism now in vampire society, if you will, that wasn't there in the previous editions. And we're really looking forward to seeing what players do with all that fluidity. Suddenly stories that really were hard to tell before are a little easier to tell, and maybe more attractive. And I'm just dying to see what players do with that.
So I appreciate we're running a little over time here. So I have two quick questions, I suppose, before we wrap up. They may be quick, up to you guys. So the first one was following on from the LARP question. When is there going to be another Grand Masquerade, which was, I think, was the New Orleans LARP you had in like 2011?
Let's see. Yeah, there have been three Grand Masquerades so far. There have been Grand Masquerades in 2010, 2011, and the most recent one was only 2 years ago in 2016, all in New Orleans. In between those years, there have been a series of similar events, which we name differently. We call them City by Night events or Masquerade by Night. There's been L.A. by Night, Nashville by Night, Las Vegas by Night, and several others. We are looking very seriously at the very real possibility of doing that next year for 2019.
Awesome. That sounds really cool. Like, I mean, I've done a very limited amount of LARP, but that sounds really cool.
It's pretty awesome when you get, 800 people in a giant series of hotel ballrooms and all playing Vampire the Masquerade LARP at the same time. Or when you get 40 people or 50 people in a hotel ballroom and have one of the most intimate, frightening vampire LARPs that you've ever played in. And the Grand Masquerade supports both. That's where Johanna and I met.
How do you get 800 people involved in a plot where they feel they have agency?
It isn't easy, and that's probably ought to be the subject of a future podcast.
I would happily have your back for that.
All right. Any other questions for us or things that you wanted to talk about?
The final thing we were going to ask is what's the release roadmap for Vampire 5th Edition and what else are you working on?
So the release roadmap for Vampire 5th Edition is pretty clear. The next things you'll see are setting books for the factions, the sects. That is the Camarilla setting book and the Anarch setting book. Johanna here wrote the vast majority, the bulk of the Anarch book and contributed many ideas to Camarilla and Core Book as well. You'll see those sometime late this fall. After that, next year, we contemplate a Sabbat source book. But also, we just announced at Gen Con that our licensee company, Onyx Path Publishing, will do Chicago by Night 5th edition. Chicago by Night was the very first Vampire the Masquerade game ever. And we're gonna look at the vampires of Chicago again and see what's happened to them in the intervening years. That's pretty exciting. We are starting to do concepting for Werewolf the Apocalypse 5th edition. And in addition to role playing games, we've announced a number of licensing partnerships with other companies. White Wolf is a transmedia company. We're also a licensing company, and that means transmedia means that we intend to tell our stories across a number of different media products. So stories of V5 will be told not only in tabletop role-playing games, but in computer games, video games, trading card games, board games, LARPs, events, and other kinds of products as well. And I think one of the strengths we have is that we have this huge family of great licensing partners who are able to do far more than we could as White Wolf. If we had to do Chicago by Night ourselves, it might be a year or two before we could get started. But because Onyx Path Publishing is already doing magnificent work with the World of Darkness and has been for a long time, they can get that book written and out to players much faster than we can. It's a really awesome relationship. And
as a fan, I just want to express some gratitude that Onyx Path are still being shown some love, because they've put out some great products in the interim time.
Absolutely.
Whilst White Wolf has maybe been in the ether. And whilst I'm really glad White Wolf is back, I'm still glad that Onyx Path are being shown that bit of love.
We are too, and we look forward to more World of Darkness books in the fifth edition from Onyx Path and from By Night Studios and from other partners that we can't even tell you about.
Excellent. Are we like to get any sort of TV shows, any sort of live action?
Television is certainly one of our ambitions. And I don't think we've made any secret of the fact that we would like to explore the possibility of long-form stories.
Oh, the depth of the material television. Available. You know,
it's incredibly rich, right? But those kinds of projects take many years to develop and materialize. And video games are an incredibly important part of our transmedia plans. We've announced exactly one video game so far, and that is the Werewolf the Apocalypse AAA game from Focus Home Interactive and Cyanide. Other games we will talk about when the time is right. Doesn't mean they're not in development. Doesn't mean they're not happening. It means it's not time to talk about them yet.
Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines was an absolutely fantastic PC RPG made by people who clearly had appreciation. Didn't nail everything, but I would highly recommend anybody who wants a Vampire the Masquerade digital fix to pick up that game and play through it.
You said the word Bloodlines, and now somebody somewhere in the world is reinstalling it.
Yeah. It might
it's
even
happening.
Be
I can hear it.
It's such a good game with so much replayability that was so immersive. The soundtrack really captured the atmosphere. So many nice touches that game. Fantastic piece of work.
I still play it.
Yeah,
I still play the latest mods.
I think we all love that game.
I like some of the ideas that CCP's White Wolf had for the MMO, but I also understand why it didn't end up making the final cut with them focusing on their other products. But I'm excited to see what else we get in the future from the new licensees and the new owners. Board game is coming out, isn't it?
The very first Vampire the Masquerade board game is coming very soon. We announced it at Gen Con. It's called Vampire the Masquerade Heritage. It's a board game from Ice Games. And what you're going to find is that it's a legacy game. And that's a very particular kind of board game. It's a 2-4 player legacy style board game. It takes about anywhere from 20 to 40 minutes to play. Players build a bloodline from vampires who complete history-based missions and challenges. And there are a number of really beautiful game components. The game essentially is about building a 700-year vampire bloodline family and trying to compete for dominance against the other vampires who are trying to do the same thing. They'll have to solve ancient mysteries. They'll have to take advantage of their allies. They'll have to wield influence. It's going to be a lot like the classic Vampire the Masquerade experience, but in a very quick, fast-paced legacy format.
And if you're playing the Ravnos, you automatically lose in the late 90s.
Well, maybe. It depends on whether or not you avoid the Inquisition, I guess.
Well, it's been fantastic to have you guys on and to talk about roleplay in general, about playing, about characters, and about the upcoming product, which I will definitely be purchasing.
Yeah, the board game sounds amazing.
Well, I'll be buying that.
And the board game and the role-playing game.
Role-playing game, the board game. Of course, we announced not too long ago that we've brought Vampire the Eternal Struggle card game.
That's coming back into being from our
partners, our licensing partners, Black Chantry, are doing that. One of the other announcements at Gen Con was a licensing partnership with Belladonna's Closet, which is a Los Angeles-based...
Is this the makeup?
Yeah, that's a cosmetics company. And they've they've just announced pre-orders for a V5 themed makeup line, which, as far as we can tell from public response, is going to be just freaking amazing.
It seems like an odd combination of partnership until you factor in the sheer presence of World of Darkness in the LARP community.
You don't say.
It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I think what you're going to find is that themed cosmetic sets, themed makeup sets, everything from Disney to Marvel, are really popular. People really enjoy choosing color palettes and color choices from their favorite story worlds. And there's no reason why Vampire can't also be one of those story worlds.
Yeah, as we've already established, it's a fantastic story world with decades of writing, depth, change.
And awesome makeup fashions.
Are we going to see a lot of trench coats and katanas in V5? I suppose that's the comparison to make with early. How much is the V1 influence carried over?
I think the V1 influence is carried over quite a lot. However, the way it's carried a lot, because V1, like first edition Vampire, that was a contemporary game when it came out. It was a game set in that time, following the fashions of that time. And that is the idea that's being carried forward. So V5 is also a contemporary game following the fashions of the day today, like right now. The kind of styles that we see in modern youth culture and subcultures and so on. And that also, that means that visually in terms of style, it's changed quite a lot, but the kind of ideas underneath those visual decisions and how everything looks like are actually quite very much the same ideas.
So which clan's going to be full of hipsters?
Which one?
Which full clan's going to be full of hipsters?
I think the answer is, come on, it's the Toreador. No? Yes? No?
No. Oh, what a question. Okay.
Well, it's been fantastic to have you guys. It's been really interesting to talk about game design, game theory, about what makes a game fun. And ultimately, it boils down to the players at the table and their communication. Tom, what is the next subject? Are we going to draw that one out of your hat? What hat have you got today for us, Tom? Tom has many hats.
I do have many hats. I am starting to run thin on hats. I've worn that one. So I was going to say, I do have a top hat, which would probably be the most vampire-like hat I have.
The top hat you bought me doesn't fit over my massive head, Tom.
Yeah, no, this year, for your Christmas present, I'm definitely going to have to get your head measurement off you.
For your present, I'm going to measure your head. Wow, that's weird.
Yes, the hat I'm wearing this time is a sparkly silver fedora that I managed to get at a work party. So I will send a photo through. I could go put on my old
I think the sparkly fedora is fine.
That's fine.
Not Toreador.
No, I mean I will share the photo I had of me dressed as a vampire for that from the session as well, because I think that's fitting. That could be a good like cover image.
Tom once managed to play a really, really convincing vampire in torpor by not speaking for a session.
Yeah.
Challenging.
It was so challenging. I'll send through that photo. But I will draw our random topic from the hat. Well, there's randomness for you, Mike. We've managed to get RPGs again.
Oh, okay. Out of how many choices?
Out of 12 different categories, we've got RPGs again.
And what's the next topic?
Next topic is out of...
Tell me it's not LARP. We'll be monopolizing Johanna.
It's not LARP. Actually, we have to add LARP to the list. So our next one is... It's on online streams.
Online streams. And you are launching an online stream with Geek and Sundry. What's that going to be called?
Play by Night, Los Angeles by Night.
Los Angeles by Night. Excellent. Who's going to be playing in Los Angeles by Night? And more importantly, who is going to be storytelling it, Jason?
Ooh, good questions. Good questions. I will answer them just because we like you, though. We have a regular cast of four incredible players. We have Erica Ayishi, Alexander.
Yes, I've seen her on Dice Camera Action. Mm-hmm.
Alexander Ward, who you may not have seen on Geek and Sundry, but you might have seen him on American Horror Story. We have B. Dave Walters, who is currently running Theogony of Kairos, D&D live stream on Maze Arcana. He was also on the Inkwell Society and hosts his own shows on Geek and Sundry, talking about various fandoms. And Cynthia Marie, who is on Sirens of the Realms with Satine Phoenix, which is one of my favorite D&D live streams. He's also on Arcana High, which is basically Dungeons & Dragons meets Harry Potter meets Saved by the Bell, a really unique live D&D stream. And she's an avid vampire LARPer.
That sounds distinctly 80s.
You think? Well, we'll see. I would check it out. I don't think you'll think that once you see it.
Excellent. Send me a link. We'll include it in the show notes.
Yeah, those are the four.
As many people there as possible.
Those are the four core vampires. We will have guest stars, and I'm not going to talk about those just yet. And I will be your storyteller.
Awesome. Look forward to it.
Thank you. That's that'll be starting in mid September on Fridays on Geek and Sundry, Twitch TV.
Well, as someone who spent the majority of my roleplay cutting my teeth on World of Darkness more than any other game setting or category, I will be excited to see a full official World of Darkness live stream, and I will have to try and bribe you to guest star one day, but I don't hold much.
Well, you'll have to come to California for starters.
Skype is a thing.
No, I have heard that.
I can just imagine Mike's face on a giant screen.
It's not something anyone wants to see. Not on a giant screen. Maybe on a small one.
I should add too that in addition to the official V5 stream, I think you can look forward to a lot of V5 streams in the very near future. We're talking to a number of different streaming teams who are very, very enthusiastic about bringing V5 to streaming in their own way, and I think that this fall you'll really be spoiled for choice. You'll be able to find a V5 stream that fits whatever taste you have for vampire. You
might even find a really ambitious Wizards of the Coast White Wolf crossover Edgelords of Waterdeep.
I know nothing about this.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And we've kept you quite late now. It's been a wonderful, wonderful time. And I think Tom has a lot of editing to do.
Yes, a fair bit.
Where is your mother? Would you like a cup of tea? Red sauce and shut your mouth. Those are the basic phrases I know in Welsh.
They will. I'm sure they will stand you in good stead throughout the length and breadth of the land. I mean, I've been to Wales.
It's a very eclectic mix, isn't it?